Today is the first ever recap and rebuttals episode of Solving JFK. We're going to go over episodes 3 through 8. We'll talk about each individual issue. At the end of each episode, I always ask that if anyone has any rebuttals or any information to add additional context, you can email me at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. I've had several people take me up on that, and we'll be going over some things that they say that I got wrong or left out. And spoiler alert, they are right about some things. So we're going to go issue by issue from episodes 3 through 8, and we'll make a determination on the nifty little Solving JFK scorecard that you can find at the bottom of the website, which is solvingjfkpodcast.com. And basically what this is it's the issue, it's what Warren Report defenders say, it's what, you know, conspiracy theorists or Warren Report critics say, and then I've got my take between strong for the Warren Report, leans in favor of the Warren Report, inconclusive, leans in favor of conspiracy, or strongly in favor of conspiracy. So those are the different ratings. I've also got my friend and host of the popular history podcast, Ohio vs. the World, Alex Hasty, as a special guest for this episode to talk about some of the bottom line recaps. Let's get to it.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Alex, welcome to Solving JFK. You have one of the best researched podcasts out there with Ohio vs. the World. I know that you're a history buff and a learned individual. Thanks for jumping in and being sort of a history observer and fellow attorney and counselor at law, just to kind of bounce some general ideas. And I was wanting to get your impressions about some of the topics in this case that we've covered so far. This is a recap and rebuttals episode.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man. I love the show, and I've been checking it out. So it's an ambitious undertaking, as any really good history podcast is. So you kind of got like a true crime / history thing going here. So keep it up. So it's been really good. Loving Solving JFK.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Again, Alex is with Ohio vs. the World. That's his podcast. Alex, you wanted to go ahead and tell everybody your information, your links, all the stuff.
Yeah. So Ohio v. the World is the name of the podcast. It's a history show where we interview the smartest, you know, best experts and authors we can find, talk about all the crazy things in American history that have some connection, loose or otherwise, with the state of Ohio where we're from. So, you know, from anything from Watergate all the way back to the early days of the American Republic and everything in between. So it's been really cool. This will be our 8th season coming up here in 2023. Ohio v. the World podcast.com, all that stuff, you know, anywhere you get your shows. And we've got a good following, and we're going to keep it going.
And if anybody wants to check out Ohio versus the World, start with episode 1, the Kent State episode. That's right out of the gate, the first one he did. And it's really, really an amazing episode if you're interested in that period of history. All right, Alex, let's jump into it here. We'll start out with episode 3. We were looking at where was Oswald before the shots were fired. So first, we have Howard Brennan, who's the only person who saw Oswald with a rifle in the window. So Brennan says that he arrived at that spot and he checked his watch at 12:18 and saw Oswald several minutes later, maybe 12:20, 12:22, something like that. Brennan didn't positively ID Oswald at the lineup, but he did ID Oswald in front of the Warren Commission. Now, if you ever go to Dallas and you go to Dealey Plaza, you can lean up against the wall where the fountain is and look at the sixth-floor southeast corner window. I stood there for a while when I went, and my impression is that you could definitely see if someone was in the window. You could see what their skin color was. You could see if they had glasses on, for example. But I just don't think there's any way that you could identify someone's face from that distance, especially if you'd never seen them before. So I think Brennan did see a white guy in the window with a gun, but we just cannot be sure that it's Oswald specifically. That's my take on Brennan. Charles Givens is the other key Warren Report witness, and I don't put a lot of weight on his testimony about seeing Oswald on the sixth floor around noon, because Givens actually changed his story from what he said initially, which was he went down from the sixth floor at 11:30, and Oswald asked him to send the elevator back up, which would be consistent with everyone else's story who said they saw Oswald around 11:50 or noon on the first floor. We know that there was a man with a gun in the window on the sixth floor. We know this from Bob Edwards, Ronald Fisher, James Worrell, Amos Ewens, and Arnold Rowland. They all say that there's a man with a gun on a high up floor. Rowland actually said that he saw two men on the sixth floor, a light-skinned man with dark hair who had the rifle, and a dark-skinned man with a bald spot. Amos Ewens also saw a man with a bald spot. Rowland gives the exact time when he saw the man as 12:15 and says that he saw these two men there until about 12:25. The Warren Report says Carolyn Arnold saw Oswald at 12:15 on the first floor, but later she told the Dallas Morning News reporter Earl Goles in 1978 that she saw Oswald at 12:25 on the second floor. So even if the original 12:15 time is correct for Carolyn Arnold seeing Oswald, that makes it almost impossible that Oswald could have been the man that Arnold Rowland saw at 12:15. If Arnold saw Oswald at 12:25 on the second floor, that makes it highly unlikely that Oswald could have been in place at 12:30, and it would also mean that there's no way Oswald was the man Brennan saw in the window several minutes after 12:18. So episode 3 and 4, the big question was, you know, could Oswald have been in place at the time the shots were fired? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'm going to ask you some questions about that, you know. I mean, I'm kind of inconclusive, but talk to me quick about two quick things. Like, you're always talking about the importance of the elevators up and down. Tell me, you know, is it like a freight elevator? Like, what's the importance of that? Some people would say he wanted the elevators set back up. And some people, like, what would make him seem more or less likely to be at the spot, whether the elevator was being sent up or down? The elevator stuff, I wasn't real clear about.
Okay.
And different witnesses say different things about that.
Right. Good question. So the idea is it's a freight elevator in the back of the building, and the elevators, incidentally, were not working at the time immediately after the shots were fired. But we know this from several, you know, Victoria Adams and Officer Baker, Roy Truly, the people that were going up and down the stairs, it's because they couldn't take the elevator. The significance of the timing of sending the elevator back down, the idea is it takes time for the elevator to come up, and he's just saying, hey, go ahead and send it back up to me so that I don't have to wait for it to come back up, because I'm going to be coming down anyway. So it's not, you know, someone could have called the elevator, you know what I mean? Like, these days we don't really think about that, but it was sort of just like a common courtesy, like, hey, go ahead and send it back up to me because I'm going to be coming right back down.
Yeah, like, send it up to me because I'm going to be killing the president.
I'd like to be able to get out of here. Gotcha. Like, sure. Yeah, that's right. So you're right. It's not definitive by any means.
Gotcha. Another point that I think is really important is, you know, the episode's called Where Was Lee Harvey Oswald When the Shots Were Fired, which is at what, 12:30?
Yes.
So my question is, wouldn't it be really important to know where he was, like, around 12:10? Like, you know, the motorcade was late, wasn't it? Wouldn't he have, wouldn't he be even more concerned about, you wouldn't know that the motorcade's late, I don't think. It's not like you'd be watching it on TV at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like, isn't it really important not just where he was when the shots were fired, but where he was 15, 20 minutes before when he thought he was going to be there, right?
Absolutely.
So where was he at 12:10?
Well, around 12, we've got a lot of witnesses that say they saw him on the first floor eating lunch, 11:50 to noon, okay?
Yeah.
And then after that, we have Carolyn Arnold, who in her initial Warren report, Warren Commission testimony, or her FBI report, it might be, I don't recall off the top of my head, but whatever her official statement was, it was that she saw Oswald at 12:15 on the first floor, okay? Which, okay, everybody else says 12:10, you know, or 12. So she says 12:15, but on the first floor. But then she was approached by Earl Goles, who is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News, I believe, in 1978. And he approached her. He was, I don't know if he was doing a book or if he was just doing some research or what, but he asked her about what she had said. And she said, no, I saw Oswald at 12:25. Because it was right before the president got there. It was about 5 minutes before the president got there. We were walking down to go outside, and I saw him at 12:25 on the second floor. So she's adamant about that. So if she saw him at 12:25 on the second floor, that, you know, nobody else saw him go from the second floor to the sixth floor, 12:25. But basically, if you, and then you also have Arnold Rowland, who sees the guy in the window, at 12:15. But if you dismiss Carolyn Arnold, then sure, Oswald could have been up there. But if you rely on what Carolyn Arnold said, especially the 12:25 timeline, it doesn't seem like he could have. But some people just say, let's just dismiss her, or we'll go with the 12:15 timeline. You know, you can kind of believe whatever you want. It's fun. My conclusion on where was Oswald before the shots were fired is that the timelines provided by Brennan, Rowland, and Carolyn Arnold make it almost impossible for Oswald to have been on the sixth floor when the shots were fired. Now, if you completely dismiss the testimony of Rowland and Arnold, then it becomes very possible that Oswald could have been on the sixth floor. I just don't have any reasons to dismiss Arnold and Rowland's testimony. So what about after the shots were fired? If Oswald was shooting from the southeast corner of the sixth floor, he would have had to run all the way across the building to the opposite northwest corner where the only stairs were located. Now, according to the Warren report, Oswald is stopped by Officer Marion Baker on the second floor near the stairs. But both Baker and Roy Truly, the building supervisor, tell the Warren Commission that Oswald was calm and not out of breath. Based on Officer Baker's Warren Commission testimony, it seems like Oswald would have had a hard time getting down the stairs to be in position on the second floor. Victoria Adams and Sandra Stiles say that they saw the assassination from the fourth floor of the school book depository and then went down the stairs immediately after. The granular details of exactly when they went down the stairs and what they saw holds an incredible amount of importance in this case. The idea is that Adams and Stiles went to the stairwell right after the shots were fired. Adams says 15 to 30 seconds after. They would have been there at approximately the same time as Oswald, so they should have heard him on the stairs. But they didn't, and neither did Jack Doherty, who was on the fifth floor and took an elevator up to the sixth floor. The Warren Commission counterpoint to Victoria Adams' testimony about leaving right after the shots were fired is that she says she saw co-workers Bill Shelley and Billy Lovelady on the first floor when she came down. But there's no way she could have seen them on the first floor unless she would have come down much later, since they went to the railroad yard right after the shots were fired and then came back. So if she saw them, and she says that she did in her testimony, then she must be wrong about the time that she left in order to allow Shelley and Lovelady time to make it back for the rail yard for the timeline to make sense. This is where Barry Ernest comes in. He interviewed Adams and Stiles for his book, The Girl on the Stairs, and they both said that they did not see Shelley or Lovelady when they came down, and that they never said that. The first rebuttal is that Adams did see Bill Shelley and Billy Lovelady when she came down, based on her interview transcript. Now, I agree that the interview transcript says that she saw Shelley and Lovelady, But Adams told Barry Ernest that this is not what she said. So he went to the National Archives to try to find the original court reporter style version of the stenographic tape. And it was missing from the National Archives and had been destroyed by the Warren Commission, according to Ernest. So the notion that she made those statements during her deposition is in question. The tape recordings from the testimony of Adams, Lovelady, and Shelley are all missing. But here's where rebuttal number one comes in.
Rebuttal number one.
I had previously said that Adams did not sign the deposition transcript. I was wrong about that. She did. It's available online from the National Archives. The fact that she did sign the deposition transcript means that she would have had a chance to see the testimony about Shelley and Lovelady. Now, whether she actually did see that testimony and she agreed with it, that's a different thing. Adams said that the agent who came to have her sign the testimony stood over her and intimidated her. This is what she told Barry Ernest. She also did not make any changes to what she originally said about 15 to 30 seconds being the amount of time she waited after the shots were fired to go down the stairs. But the bottom line is that she did sign the transcript. This is a classic fork in the road of inferences in the JFK assassination. So if you think that Oswald did it, you believe the Warren Commission, and you write off the evidentiary anomalies with the transcript as conspiratorial silliness. If you're a Warren Report skeptic, you look at this information and you see a woman who insists on what happened, and then evidence to support that what she's saying about tampering with her testimony may be true, given the missing stenographic copy and the missing tape recordings. Also, the internal Warren Commission letter from Mary Jo Stroud provides further support for what Adam said about going down the stairs immediately. It says, quote, "Miss Garner, Miss Adams' supervisor, stated this morning that after Miss Adams went downstairs, she, Miss Garner, saw Mr. Truly and the policeman come up." This shows that Adams must have gone down before Officer Baker came up, which was within 3 minutes or so of the shots being fired. Now, the next question becomes, well, why did Adams and Stiles not see Officer Baker and Roy Truly coming up the stairs? The answer that makes sense to me is that they must have got out of the stairwell before Officer Baker and Roy Truly started going up the stairs. That's the only thing that would make sense and be consistent with that story. My conclusion on this issue is that Oswald was not likely in place on the sixth floor when the shots were fired. Now, I will say, this conclusion is based exclusively on testimony. An eyewitness testimony is not always the strongest evidence, so that's a fair criticism. Having said that, my vote on this issue is that this particular issue of could Oswald have been in place leans towards the conspiracy side. Now, the open questions. If not Oswald, then who are the other men on the sixth floor? I mean, that's a big question. How did they escape the building without being seen? Someone had to fire the shots. If not Oswald, then who?
Talk about what's the importance of the Coca-Cola can. And you know, could he have purchased it? But where does that pop up? Is that just that in the Warren Report? Is that just multiple people's testimony?
It's honestly, it's gotten into the lore of the case from the movie JFK, I think, is a big part of it. Yeah. So the whole idea is, FBI says it would have taken Oswald a minute and 14 seconds to get into place after the last shot was fired. FBI reenacted Officer Marion Baker's steps, and they said it would have taken a minute and 18 seconds for him to get there. So if Oswald got there 4 seconds earlier and he had a Coke in his hand, that 4 seconds it would take to buy the Coke makes a big difference. Yeah. That's kind of what it comes down to. There are a lot of people that say that he had a Coke in his hands. But what's interesting is Officer Baker, in his initial statement, he said that he saw Oswald with a Coke in his hands, and then he went back and scratched it out and initialed it.
So that's all. He has a Coke in his hands after the president's
after,
shot.
Which yeah. goes to, did he have time to buy the Coke?
Yeah.
It's about the time.
It's a weird thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Another thing I'd never heard until your episode 4 is, the power went out in that building right before the president showed up. What's up with that?
I believe the elevator wasn't working. I forget what the exact detail is off the top I haven't looked at that in a second, but yeah, the power went out. And I just note it. To answer your question, I don't have like a theory around it, but I'm throwing it out there for the future as something that's worth going back and doing a deep dive on. And yeah, and I don't.
I've written in my notes here, the power went out, WTF?
I know.
Capital letters.
I think it's weird. That's suspicious, right? And especially if it went out just to that building, that seems really suspicious. But, you know, it still comes down to, you're going to take my position and say that it leans towards the conspiracy side in terms of could Oswald have been in place. You have to answer, okay, well then who did it and how did they get out and why did nobody see them and where did they come from and, you know, who were they? It's a good question. All right, let's talk about the next issue. Episode 5, how did Oswald get the rifle in the building? That's the big question. First, did Oswald bring the gun in the building in a paper sack under the guise of curtain rods? The Warren Report says that Oswald was seen by Lenny May Randall and Buell Wesley Frazier with a bag that was about 2 feet long. Oswald then got past everyone in the building without being seen with this bag and stashed it on the sixth floor. Frazier and Randall were both mistaken about the size of the bag because the one found on the sixth floor was 38 inches long and the rifle was almost 35 inches long. On the other hand, Frazier measured the area in the back seat of the car where the bag was located, and he insisted that Oswald carried the bag between his bent fingers and his armpit. But that's not consistent with the way that the prints were found on the bag. It's easy to say that Frazier and Randall must have been wrong about the size of this bag, but why would Frazier insist that Oswald carry the bag that way? Something I left out in the first episode is that Frazier told the Warren Commission that the paper bag he saw was, quote, a little paper sack you get out of a grocery store, but the one in evidence is made out of brown wrapping paper with sealed tape. It was a homemade bag. Maybe this is a small thing, but that's different from the bag that Frazier said he saw. There's also the question of whether we can believe Frazier. He may not have told the truth about dropping Oswald at the door versus parking in the parking lot, according to Edward Shields. But the bigger issue with Frazier is the midnight polygraph that the police said he passed, but was actually inconclusive. And all of the records of this polygraph have been destroyed. I ultimately think that's weird, but it doesn't really prove anything. It's just worth noting. So this is where rebuttal number two comes in.
Rebuttal number two.
If Frazier and Randall were going to lie about the bag, wouldn't they have told a better lie? Them saying that it was 2 feet long when it was really a little over 3 feet long doesn't fit perfectly, so they must not be lying. So this is the argument is, you know, if... What reason do Frazier and Randall have to lie? I don't know. I agree. That's a big question. And I don't know that they were lying necessarily, but I don't know if they have a reason to lie. It's confusing, you know. A paper bag with curtain rods was never found. The question of was there ever curtain rods? That's a legit question. You know, it seems to me that there were never curtain rods, and curtain rods was just the story. So I get this point about, you know, if Frazier and Randall are going to lie to further the official story, their testimony doesn't fit the story. Thus, if they're lying, they should have told a better lie. I get this point, and it's one of the reasons I reserve the possibility that Oswald could have gotten the gun in the way the Warren Report says, but there are a lot of things that don't make sense in this case.
You know, one thing about that, there's so much gun paper sack talk in this episode. You know, is it possible he could have brought it another time, another way? Then, I mean, I guess he would have had to stash it somewhere there. But I mean, where do you come out on that? Because the 2 foot bag, you can't put a high powered rifle even broken down in that small of a bag, right?
Right. It wouldn't fit. The bag itself is like 34.8 inches, 35 inches, basically. So almost 3 feet. And even if you were going to carry just the broken down portion of the gun, it wouldn't work in the way that Frazier talks about him carrying it between his fingertips and his armpit.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know on that. I think this is one of those facts that either it was planted, that bag got there somehow. So it's one or the two, either it's an elaborate frame up job or Oswald did it.
Gotcha.
Right? Like, yeah. How did it get there? You know? So that's what that tells me. But I think it's ultimately inconclusive. I mean, just the thing of like, okay, nobody sees him with the bag. And here's the other thing, other than Frazier.
Who's Frazier again?
Buell Wesley Frazier. He's the guy that gave Oswald a ride to work. And him and his sister are the only ones that are on the record saying they saw Oswald with this paper bag. Okay. Long paper sack. So they say it's a different length than the one on the record. And people go, well, if they were lying, they would have told a better lie. They would have said it was the same length as the one that was found. If they were lying, they didn't coordinate their lies very well. Agree 1,000%. That's a mystery. But another reason that makes me question whether the bag that they saw him with, if they saw him with it, is the one that was found, is that Frazier describes it as being a store bought bag as opposed to the makeshift bag out of wrapping paper. He says it was just like a long lunch bag, basically, but it was one that you would buy at a store. And he says that the one that they had wasn't the same type that he was talking about, the same type that he saw. So, but again, he says it's a different length. One thing that's a little compelling on the length part of it is he says that he remembered where it came to in his backseat of his car exactly. And I don't know if that, now the credibility of that is like, well, is it between two landmarks? Is it like from the seatbelt to the middle crease or something like that? If so, that's credible. But if it's just like, oh, I don't know, I was eyeballing it, then that becomes less credible, I guess, you know. My conclusion regarding episode 5 is that it's not clear whether Oswald brought the rifle in the building in the paper sack, as the Warren Report says. The paper bag that was found in the sniper's nest had to get there somehow, but there's nobody who saw Oswald carrying a paper bag other than Frazier and Randall. And the bag Frazier and Randall saw doesn't match the size of the one in evidence, and the prints on the bag don't match how Oswald was seen carrying it by Frazier. Also, it's a different bag versus what Frazier described. And the FBI expert says that there's no creases or oil or anything to show that a rifle had been in it. So I think it's inconclusive. That's my rating for this issue, inconclusive. The open questions would be, you know, if Oswald says he brought his lunch that day and people say that they saw Oswald eating his lunch, where did he get his lunch from if he didn't bring it? So does that, you know, was there a place he could have gone to quickly get his lunch that would have made sense? Did anyone see him leave the building to go get lunch? Did they have a vendor there on site, you know, selling lunch? These are questions to look into. If people saw him eating lunch, you would think that he probably brought his lunch. But Frazier never mentions a lunch bag. Oswald, for what it's worth, says that he did bring a lunch bag. All right, moving on to episode 6. We got a few different issues in this one. Let's go one by one. How incriminating are Oswald's fingerprints on the boxes in the sniper's nest? Fingerprints were found on the top of 3 boxes that were moved, but not on the bottom 2 boxes. His palm print was found on one of the boxes behind where the shooter would be, and only the palm print was there within the last 3 days. We don't know how old those other prints were. Now, in addition to Oswald, there were 12 other people who worked there on the 6th floor, but none of the other employees' fingerprints were on those boxes. Now, if you listen to what Warren Report critics say, they'll say that this proves that the evidence was manufactured because there's no way that the other 12 employees didn't touch those boxes. You would think at least one of them would have. Now, Warren Report defenders say that this proves Oswald did it because no one else touched the boxes, only him. What else do you want? So my conclusion on that issue is Oswald worked there. And I think the fingerprint evidence in the sniper's nest doesn't look good for him, but it's ultimately inconclusive because he touched boxes and he worked on that floor. The open question here is, on the day of the assassination and the few days before it, did any of the other employees touch those boxes as part of their job?
What are your thoughts on the, Stuart Reed has these photos, like one of them, it shows the bus that, you know, it's down at the textbook book depository. And then Stuart Reed is also at the Texas Theater taking pictures. It's just kind of weird that there's a guy who got photos of both of those times. It's a guy, Stuart Reed. Have you done any research into those photos?
Yeah. Okay. So on the Stuart Reed photos, I think it's weird that he got Oswald when he was on the bus and that he got him at the Texas Theater. I think him getting Oswald on the bus is kind of incidental, you could argue. And you could even argue that the Texas Theater is incidental. But both of them together is what's weird. Plus, you know, combined with he worked in the Panama Canal Zone and he came in just for that thing. And then he left and the Warren Report never talked to him except that he said that you can use these pictures. So, you know, there are people who think that Stuart Reed was part of the operation to document what happened that day. But I don't know if I would put weight into that. I only bring it up because it's interesting. And again, I don't know if it proves anything, but hey, interesting that the guy that took a picture of Oswald being arrested out of the Texas Theater also has a picture of Oswald leaving on the bus he's on. And he's in the military and we don't know anything else about it.
Yeah, I agree. It's more interesting that he's at the Texas Theater. You know, that's kind of the weird one.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC, it's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these, so when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep. Flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
Next issue. The Warren Report says that the 38-inch long paper sack found in the sniper's nest proves that Oswald carried it and that he had the murder weapon in it, because it was found in the sniper's nest and is fairly close to what Lenny Mae Randall and Buell Wesley Frazier described. We have Oswald's fingerprints on a paper sack that's about 50% longer than the one described by them, but it is found in the sniper's nest. The only Warren Report critic counterargument to the paper sack is that the exact type of fingerprints that they have are weird. A right palm print and a left index fingerprint only. That's all that's on the bag for Oswald. If it was the same bag that Frazier saw him carry, Oswald's fingerprints from his right hand should be on the edge of the bag, and there would be no prints on the top of it based on how Frazier saw him carry it under his armpit. Of course, he could have touched it differently when he was out of sight of Frazier. Sure. My conclusion on this is inconclusive. This piece of evidence looks bad for Oswald. It makes it such that if Oswald didn't fire the shots and bring the rifle in, you know that he was definitely framed because it had to get there somehow. What about Roger Craig?
Can we believe him? How credible is Roger Craig? Craig says that he saw a few things that contradict the official Warren Report story. An Oswald lookalike running out of the back of the school book depository down Dealey Plaza and getting into a Nash Rambler. Helen Forrest and James Pennington also saw this man. Craig also says that Oswald told him, "That station wagon belongs to Mrs. Payne. Do not bring her into this." When Craig told Oswald that he had seen him leave Dealey Plaza in a car when he talked to him at the police department. He reinforces the original Seymour Weitzman and Eugene Boone story about the sixth-floor rifle being a Mauser. Craig also had four separate attempts on his life and ultimately died under what I think are questionable circumstances. My conclusion on Craig, whether or not we can trust him, is that it's hard to tell. But Craig seems credible to me. He had nothing to gain, and he had a lot to lose. Ultimately, we don't know. But I tend to believe Roger Craig.
How many people, this is just a general question that I just thought of when I was listening to episode 6 and 7, really. How many people would you say have died under kind of suspicious circumstances that are involved in assassination? I mean, in the 5, 10, 15 years after it happened, I mean, can you just put a number? I'm not saying an exact number, but give the listeners like an idea of how many people have kind of died suspiciously.
Well, there's a guy named Richard Belzer who's got a book called Hit List that goes over this exact topic. I'm trying to think what the exact number is. It's
like
a lot.
10?
No, it's probably, I've seen the number be as big as 100. Okay. I've seen it be a large number. And I will cover that eventually. I'm trying not to get bogged down into that because then what happens is each individual, so you go, there's 100 people who have died under suspicious circumstances. Then it becomes a game of now we're going to audit each one of those 100
right.
people. And then it's like 37. Die. Yeah. 37 of them had heart attacks and 25 mm-hmm. of them had car accidents. And then it's like, so you go, okay, well, a lot of these don't sound like they're related. And then the church committee happens and we find out that they have a heart attack gun that exists that they can just use on people, you know? So it's like, well, it's far-fetched, but possible, some of them. So to me, I like to look at incentives, right? So the theme back and forth is between, you know, Warren Report defenders and people who think it was a conspiracy is, wow, all these people who come forward with conspiracy facts are just trying to make money for a book. I think if you say something, if you're a person who's on the record saying something that is bad for the Warren Report and you're someone who would be a witness people would listen to, and you don't make any money for what you say, and then you die afterwards, that makes me want to really dive into the substance of what you were saying more. That's me.
Gotcha.
I try not to play that game yet. I might play that game later, but as of right now, I haven't dove into the how many people have died. There are people, but if you think that Oswald did it alone, then all of that is total BS. So I want to kind of get through the basics, and then we'll dive into that stuff later. Let's talk about episode 7, ordering the rifle to the P.O. box and the Mauser. Did Oswald order the Mannlicher Carcano rifle in evidence? Well, his name is on the P.O. box that the rifle was shipped to using his alias, A. Hiddell, which was found in his wallet with his picture when he was arrested. The order was received for that gun in March of 1963 by Kleins per the microfilm. But, on the other hand, the P.O. box was being monitored by the FBI at that time. No witnesses recall Oswald receiving it. The deposit slip is from February, but the order is supposed to be from March. The P.O. box name did not match the order name, and you would think that would result in a return to sender. Here's where rebuttal number 3 comes in.
Rebuttal number 3.
The FBI was not monitoring Oswald's mail. There's no evidence for this. Okay, so we talked about the information provided to FBI agent James Hostie by informant T2 that Oswald was working with Fair Play for Cuba. But this info was provided in the form of, quote, an undated letter from Oswald, which the FBI has a copy of. So who was T2? It was later disclosed that T2 was Harry Holmes, the Dallas postal inspector. So to answer this rebuttal, it's true that it has not been definitively proven that the FBI was spying on every single Oswald communication. But it has been proven that the Dallas postal inspector opened Oswald's mail on at least this one occasion in April of 1963 and made a copy of it. So to believe that the FBI was not spying on Oswald would be to believe that this was a one-off incident. That doesn't make a ton of sense to me. The counterpoint from Warren Report defenders is that if the FBI was monitoring Oswald's mail, then they would have intercepted the rifle and stopped him from getting it. They say that the rifle not being intercepted is proof that the FBI wasn't monitoring Oswald's mail because the FBI would have intervened and saved the day. Okay, well, how do you explain the April 1963 letter that Harry Holmes copied? That's my question. This is one more split point in inferences. I think reasonable people can disagree. What do you make of this one instance? I mean, are we to believe that the FBI only did this once and they didn't see the incoming mail? They only were scanning his outgoing mail? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of weird stuff with it. The fact that they were on this P.O. box, I mean, when did the gun get shipped to him? Do you know?
The gun was shipped in March, I believe. It was in March of 1963.
Okay. No, I don't have any like revelatory comments on that other than it's really strange that they were on that P.O. box. And then, you know, I that's again, you know, you're opening my eyes to things that I didn't know about.
I think it just goes back to, it doesn't prove that the FBI was monitoring every single one of Oswald's, you know, it doesn't prove they were monitoring all of his mail, but yeah. It leaves open the possibility for that. I guess that would be maybe a more accurate way to state what that fact means.
Yeah. I mean, if you were pro Cuba in 1963, you were very likely being watched.
You know? Yeah, true. Rebuttal number four. This is a big one.
Rebuttal number four.
2162 was only for concealable firearms, not rifles. So I was sent a document as part of this rebuttal from the Post Office Service's Transmittal Letter 112, dated June 29th, 1962. And Section 125.5 says that it's referring to, quote, concealable firearms. Now, the only mention of Form 2162 on this document is that it says that a receipt for delivery must be taken on Form 2162, delivery receipt for firearms. Then I was able to look at Form 2162 itself, and the form specifically references the concealable handguns section 125.54. So my statutory reading of this provision as an attorney is Form 2162 only applies to handguns and not rifles. Mark Lane originally cited in his book Rush to Judgment from the 1963 U.S. Postal Regulations. Lane says that Section 846.53A says that it covers, quote, delivery receipts for firearms and statements by shippers of firearms. So, in other words, it's back to, well, it's not specific that, you know, it doesn't apply to all weapons. I tried to find the original 1963 postal regulations, and I couldn't find it. So I don't know if this is true or not. The bottom line on this rebuttal is that if you're relying on Form 2162 as one of the main reasons for thinking Oswald didn't get the gun, you really can't use that as evidence anymore because it's unclear at best. But from what I've seen after getting this rebuttal, it does look to me like Form 2162 only covers concealable weapons like handguns. It probably was not required for a rifle shipment.
Next issue.
Was the rifle found on the sixth floor a Mauser or the Mannlicher Carcano that's in evidence today? Sheriff Eugene Boone, who discovered the rifle with Sheriff Roger Craig and Deputy Constable Seymour Weitzman, initially said it was a Mauser. Roger Craig says that he read Mauser off of the barrel himself from inches away, but that all depends on whether you think Roger Craig is credible or not. There was also an envelope found by the ARRB that said 7.65 bullet found in Dealey Plaza. But I don't put a ton of weight into that. Here's where rebuttal number 5 comes in.
Rebuttal number 5.
Captain Fritz did not say that he called it a Mauser originally. This is true. I said that Fritz admitted that he called it a Mauser initially. I misread his Warren Commission testimony. When Fritz is asked if there was any conversation about a Mauser, he said, quote, "I couldn't be sure." And when Fritz was asked if he ever described it as a Mauser, he did unequivocally say no. Still, it remains true that the sheriff who found the gun, Eugene Boone, did say in his Warren Commission testimony that he believed Captain Fritz identified the gun as a Mauser. This is ultimately a small issue that doesn't change anything, but it's still worth correcting the record, and I will take the L on this one. I was wrong. My conclusion overall in the Carcano versus Mauser saga is that it was a Carcano unless there was some elaborate scheme to use a Mauser but frame Oswald with a Carcano. Obviously, the National Archives has the Carcano. That's the one that we got. There's a picture of Lieutenant Day, the same guy from the Palm Print saga, holding the rifle by the strap, taking it out of the building, and that matches the Carcano, okay? So all the evidence is that it's the Carcano. But it's just crazy that we have the first three sheriffs who showed up, the guy that found the gun, Boone, Weitzman, who ran a gun store, a sporting goods store that sold guns, okay? But he was an expert on guns. And then Roger Craig, and all of them say it's a Mauser. Now here's what I put a little bit of stock in. The story is they thought it was a Mauser at first, and then Captain Fritz from the police department got there, looked at it, and said, it's a Carcano. See right here, it says Carcano. And then they all go, oh, we were mistaken. It's a Carcano. That's like the official story. But in Boone and Weitzman's affidavits, their signed written affidavits from that day, which didn't happen immediately after this happened. This happened later on that day.
Right.
They wrote that it was a Mauser, and they wrote the granular details of what they saw in the gun.
Yeah.
So it's weird to me that their affidavit says that it was a Mauser if that was later in the day and they would have already been corrected on that. What's your take on that?
I mean, I thought one of the cool things you did is you play, you know, 6 or 7 different news clips from that day where they say a Mauser was found, a Mauser, a Mauser. There's a Mauser on the 6th floor of Texas Bank Depository. I always get frustrated when there's breaking news, you know, and you're watching the news and they have all this information. And it's not, you know, flushed out. It ends up being wrong. But we're talking about, these are people who would, I couldn't tell you a Carcano from a Mauser, you know, gave me $1 million. I don't know anything really about guns. But these are people that know about guns. These are people that made sworn affidavits on the day before any of this, you know, conspiracy. Could it have been Oswald, could have been someone else. Everyone in the world was convinced that it was Oswald that day.
Mm-hmm.
And in the days after that, really, at least until Jack Ruby showed up and kind of threw a wrench in things, right? So
yeah.
It's really weird. And it's something I had never even heard. I just assumed that it was also a gun that was found. I'd never even looked into any of that. You know, again, I'm not an expert. I'm just a listener. But I thought that was really compelling and really concerning.
Let's get into episode 8. What about the cartridges? J. Edgar Hoover said that the cartridges could not be tied to a specific weapon. This is what I said initially regarding the cartridges. Here comes rebuttal number 6.
Rebuttal number 6.
Hoover wasn't saying that the cartridges were not tied to the weapon. He was just saying that one specific aspect of linking the cartridges, the extractor marks, could not be used to link them. Also, FBI agent Frazier says in his Warren Report testimony that he did link the cartridges to the rifle. I looked at the documents for this rebuttal and the testimony that was provided in it, and I think it's a good point. We can't rely on Hoover's letter to say that the cartridges were not linked to the gun, and we actually do have an FBI firearms expert, Agent Frazier, who says that he did link the cartridges to the gun. Ultimately, there are still competing experts on whether the cartridges could have been fired that day and whether they came from the gun, but I don't think the issue of the cartridges being tied to the gun is one that anyone hangs their hat on. Now, of course, the cartridges had to come from somewhere, and the rifle found on the sixth floor is the most obvious answer. I never put a lot of weight into the idea that those cartridges came from somewhere else. Even if Oswald was being framed, you would expect the cartridges used to frame him would be the ones that matched the gun found on the floor. So, no huge surprise there. My conclusion on this issue is that it's inconclusive, but if anything, it leans towards the Warren Report side unless the evidence was planted. The next issue, do the paraffin tests incriminate Oswald? Well, his hand tested positive and his cheek tested negative. And there are disputes about whether a cheek would be expected to test positive when firing a Carcano rifle. Believe it or not, I know it's hard in this case to believe it, different experts say different things. When it comes to the nitrates on Oswald's hands, they were mostly on his palm side, when you would expect the nitrates to land on the back of his hand because he'd be holding the gun. Also, Oswald was seen holding a newspaper that would produce positive nitrate results. We know that he was reading a newspaper that day because Charles Givens told the FBI that in his statement to them. Ultimately, the Warren Commission says that the paraffin test is not credible and they don't rely on it. And my conclusion on the paraffin test is that it's inconclusive. I agree that the paraffin test is unreliable. And if it was reliable, it would be one more disputed issue. But I tend to think it would help Oswald because there's more nitrates found on his palms as opposed to the back of his hands. The next issue, how incriminating is Oswald's palm print that was found on the barrel of the Carcano? A palm print matching Oswald's is found on the underside of the barrel, and it's the only one tying Oswald to the gun. Initially, this looks and sounds really bad for Oswald. His prints are on the gun, what else do you want? But the details make the story a lot cloudier. The gun was sent to the FBI from the Dallas police with cellophane covering the trigger guard only, that's the only area of the rifle that was covered, because Lieutenant Day believed there were prints on the trigger guard that could be used. Then, when FBI agent Latona looks at the gun, he finds no prints there. Then, several days later, after providing the gun to the FBI, Lieutenant Day sends an index card with Oswald's palm print that he says was taken from the underbarrel of the gun. It was lifted. And the only witness that we have for this is Lieutenant Day. Now, we have a rebuttal coming up on that topic. But if Lieutenant Day thought that there was a palm print on the underbarrel of the gun, I would think that he would have wrapped it in cellophane too, just like he wrapped the trigger guard to protect it. Lieutenant Day also didn't tell Vincent Drain, the FBI agent, about this palm print, according to Drain, although Day says that he did. Even Warren Commission Chief Counsel Rankin had doubts about the legitimacy of this palm print, as shown in the internal Warren Commission memos we talked about in Episode 8. The counterpoint, of course, is that Lieutenant Day, if anything, was negligent, and he should have wrapped the palm print in cellophane and sent the lifted palm print to the FBI sooner, but he really expected Agent Latona to be able to find that palm print. So here's rebuttal number 7.
Rebuttal number 7.
Lieutenant Day is not the only one we have to rely on for the idea that he lifted and later mailed the palm print on an index card. The FBI laboratory examiners said in a September 11th, 1964 letter that, quote, the laboratory examiners were able to positively identify this lift as having come from the assassination rifle in the area of the wooden foregrip. This conclusion was based on a comparison of irregularities in the surface of the metal of the barrel with the impressions of these irregularities as shown in the lift. This is true. The FBI did say that they believed that Lieutenant Day's lifted print could have come from the barrel area, and they say that it made sense because the irregularities matched. This fact does take the air out of the argument that the palm print was planted to some extent. But you still have the fact that Day didn't wrap the palm print in cellophane like he did the trigger guard. And FBI agent Drain insisted that Day never said anything about the palm print when Drain picked up the rifle from him. Also, Agent Latona said that there was no evidence that the print had been lifted. My conclusion on this is inconclusive. In light of the last rebuttal, I now list this as a toss-up.
You know, the fingerprint on the gun and whether that was, you know, something that was manufactured or kind of, you know, done by the investigators. I mean, that's a really big issue, right? Because I mean, if that's the case, that you can show or you know, be a preponderance of the evidence that it was planted on the gun. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing, you know?
Right.
I mean, that's a really big point. And I
yeah,
just talk about, you know, I know you already talked a little bit about the rebuttal, but I think it's super important because if it's
sure,
if you can show that, then it's all the rest of it's all wide open.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you have, when it comes to the palm print itself, the whole question is, can we believe Lieutenant Day? Now, I will say the rebuttal that we got is because I had said before, Lieutenant Day is the only person, you know, his testimony that he lifted this palm print and then he put it on the index card and sent it in. That's yeah. The only evidence we have for the palm print. There also was an FBI, there was a report and an FBI lab report that said that the grooves of the fingerprint of the lifted print that was sent are consistent with the irregularities in the barrel. So in other words, yeah, hey this you know, Lieutenant Day's story checks out. The two things that I think are weird about it, so it's not proven and it's disputed, it's intensely disputed, okay? And people who say the Warren Report got it right would say that it's done, it is proven, it's proven that it was the lifted print, case closed, we're done. That's what they, but my concern with that is why was the cellophane not covering the palm print when he handed it to him, to the FBI agent? And why is the FBI agent putting up a fight with Day when it comes to, you know, hey, you didn't tell me that. You said you told me that, but you didn't tell me that. Also, the FBI's expert that looked at it at first said there was no evidence of the lifted print there. So he said he specifically ruled that out. But what it comes down to is, if you later determine that there are facts, all these are inconclusive to me because there's counterarguments on the other side. But the door is open for Oswald to have not done it. We're headed towards a split of two scenarios. Either Oswald did it, as the Warren Report says, or he had to have been framed. There's not a scenario where he didn't do it and he wasn't framed, because the evidence convicts him if you just look at the evidence that exists.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch. Well, I really enjoyed the show, man. I mean, I'm not a huge conspiracy theorist guy, but I think JFK is so universally accepted. I mean, the polls are 60-70% of Americans believe that it didn't, that we don't know everything and that maybe the Warren Report doesn't have it right. I mean, so you're really hitting on something at a time when, you know, this is kind of the number one American conspiracy out there. That's cool.
It's the one you can talk about and not be called crazy. So that's I enjoy that. All right. Well, hey, we got to wrap it up here.
Yeah, let's do this again in like 10 or 20 episodes once my mind has been completely blown, okay? You can help bring me back to the brink.
All right. Thanks again. And hey, where can everybody find Ohio versus the World?
Yeah, anywhere you get your pods, man. Ohio Be the World podcast. We're on the Evergreen podcast. Remember, that's evergreenpodcast.com. You can find all our episodes, you know, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere.
All right. Okay. Alex Hasty from Ohio versus the World. Thanks a lot, Alex.
All right. See you, bud.
We are back with episode 9 next Tuesday. We'll start looking at Dealey Plaza and going through all of the witness statements.
In Dallas, Texas, 3 shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard.
Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information. I'm getting